and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, this afternoon at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, President Obama delivered a speech that he called, quote, the state of our democracy, unquote. It was a clear beginning to his campaigning for Democrats during the midterm elections, and it focused on voter turnout. He also pushed back hard against President Trump, calling him a symptom of the country's problems, but not the disease. If Trump as president is a symptom, does Obama include himself as part of the disease? Next, Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right frontrunner in Brazil's presidential election, was stabbed in the stomach and seriously injured last night during a campaign rally. His assailant was caught. Bolsonaro has courted controversy throughout the campaign. Then, Senator Bernie Sanders announced a new bill yesterday called the Stop Bezos Act, which would require companies to pay for any vital social programs that their employees use because they're paid so little. This is after Amazon became the world's second company to be valued at over $1 trillion, despite paying its workers little and eliminating as many jobs as possible. While Amazon and Jeff Bezos earn more and more money, they actually eliminate people's jobs and lower basic incomes. And then Apple plans to create an online tool for police to formally request data about its users and to assemble a team to train police about what data can and cannot be obtained from the company. We'll look at what this means for privacy. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Illinois and President Obama. This afternoon at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, President Obama delivered a speech that he called, quote, the state of our democracy, unquote. It was a clear beginning to his campaign for Democrats during the midterms, and it focused on voter turnout. He also pushed back hard against President Trump, calling him a symptom of the country's problems, but not the disease. If Trump as president is a symptom, does Obama include himself as a part of the disease? We're joined from Chicago by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Dan, good to have you back. Dan, the speech is being billed on the news networks as a major national address. Why? Should we care what Barack Obama has to say about these issues?
Oh, I think so very much. I mean, Obama is many people still think of Obama as their president. He is immensely popular, and he seems to stand out strikingly against Trump. So therefore, his message is very important.
Yeah, and Twitter right now is, you know, sort of blanketed with, this is my president. I mean, this is obviously a big part of the population. I want to play an audio clip from Barack Obama to listen to it and have Daniel Lazar, our guest, comment. Let's listen.
Each time we've gotten closer to those ideals, somebody somewhere has pushed back. The status quo pushes back. Sometimes the backlash comes from people who are genuinely, if wrongly, fearful of change. More often it's manufactured by the powerful and the privileged who want to keep us divided and keep us angry and keep us cynical because that helps them maintain the status quo and keep their power and keep their privilege. And you happen to be coming of age during one of those moments. It did not start with Donald Trump. He is a symptom, not the cause.
Okay. By the way, Daniel, as a socialist and somebody who's been protesting against Trump, I've been carrying a sign along with some of our colleagues out in the streets that says, Trump is a symptom, capitalism is the disease. I don't think that's what Barack Obama meant, though. What's your take?
Well, I think it's a, I mean, I think that Obama is making a self-serving argument, that he is a force of change. His only fault was trying too hard to do good, and that that Trump represents the inevitable backlash. But how was Hillary a force for change? How was the disaster that she wrought in the Middle East or Central America, how was that somehow beneficial? How was that good? I mean, Americans who voted for Trump were voting against an alarming deterioration in their society and in foreign affairs. So Obama is not willing to take responsibility for any of the harms he did or allowed to happen. He's painting his administration in the most favorable colors possible.
Yeah. And one thing that I thought was interesting, Obama made a forceful presentation for basically what can only be considered a whitewashing of U.S. history, something that Donald Trump does as well. Of course, every time he said that we were making progress, we were always going forward, we were supporting the underdogs, and when we had a problem, we addressed the problem. There was Vietnam, but we had a debate about Vietnam as if it was just a debate and not like, you know, a million Vietnamese died and 58,000 Americans died in this war of aggression. And then there was the war in Iraq. And, you know, we had a debate, but sort of like it all sorts out at the end. And America's really a good and wonderful place. And to the extent that there are these little problems like, you know, wars of aggression or earlier slavery or whatever, you know, we had a debate. It's this kind of whitewashing. And at the same time, when you talk about the privileged and the powerful, the status quo pushing back against people who are making change, it's as if Barack Obama was not part of the privileged and powerful, as if all the problems of today and of Donald Trump were such that they sort of just fell from the skies, as if he wasn't part of this problem.
Yeah, it's a fairy tale version of American history in which Americans are always right, even when they do wrong. You know, Vietnam was a horrible crime. Iraq was one of the great blunders and great crimes of the post-war period. And these were not just these flowed out of the whole structure of American politics. And under Obama, beginning in 2011, the damage widened. I mean, he destroyed how many countries? Libya, Syria, Yemen. This is really a remarkable record, which Obama is not taking responsibility for.
Yeah, and also the baiting of the Republican Party on the issue of Russia is also, it's true demagogy. And I want to quote what Obama said. He says, "What happened to the Republican Party?" he asked. "Their former organizing principle in foreign policy was anti-communism." Then he went on, "Now they're cozying up to the former head of the KGB. Okay, now, like, you have to
so
just
ridiculous.
You just have to unpack that. First of all, when Obama came into office, he sent Hillary Clinton to meet with Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia under Putin, with a big red reset button. And that button said, you know, the button was labeled, you know, time for reset, meaning better relations with Russia. And Obama and Bush before that said he wanted better relations with Putin. Now, the Soviet Union is no more. Russia is not led by the Communist Party of Russia or the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. It's true that Putin is a former KGB, but what Obama is suggesting is that while the Republicans used to be anti-communist, now they're with the communists in the Kremlin. I mean, that's actually the level of demagogy here, or at least that's how I read it.
It's bonkers. It's an upside down view of history. And what, you know, and what Obama did in the Ukraine, or at least allowed to be done, was extraordinary. You know, Obama in a speech took a swipe at Trump for refusing to forthrightly condemn Nazis in Charlottesville. But in fact, the U.S. sponsored and collaborated with and encouraged a vast growing Nazi element in the Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine is now a country that is overrun by ultra-right militias, not despite what the U.S. did, but because of it. And Obama refuses to face facts.
Daniel Lazar is our guest. Dan, let's real quick talk about what Obama had to say about the New York Times op-ed from the anonymous resistance warrior inside the Trump administration, who is protecting the country anonymously from Trump's own worst impulses, as they said. What did he say? What did Obama say?
Well, he said something really important. He said that this is not democracy because these kinds of elements are not democratically accountable. They were not elected. And he's absolutely correct. But it's an implicit rebuke to the New York Times, which essentially labeled these sources, these anonymous officials, as somehow part of a legitimate constitutional response to Trump's destruction and destructive tendencies. And that's another example of turning reality on its head. I mean, encouraging these anonymous officials to somehow take control of the government from within it's akin to calling for a coup d'etat. And this is what the New York Times has been doing, and this is what Obama, in an implicit rebuke to the Times, now quite correctly condemns.
Yeah, he said the claim that everything will turn out okay because there are people inside the White House who are secretly aren't allowing or aren't following the president's order, that's not a check. That's not how our democracy is supposed to work. These people aren't elected. They're not accountable. They're not doing us a service by actively promoting 90% of the crazy stuff that's coming out of this White House. Don't worry, we're preventing the other 10%. That's not how things are supposed to work. That is not normal. These are extraordinary times, and they're dangerous times.
Yeah, I have to object to all this, too, because this is the same Barack Obama who approved of a kill list and was killing people, including American citizens, who had never been accused of a crime in a court of law, with impunity. This is the same Barack Obama whose attorney general told a Senate panel that the president has the constitutional right to murder American citizens on American soil without the benefit of trial. You know, all of a sudden we're deifying this guy, and there were a lot of problems for our country during Obama's tenure. I think we have to be careful of this.
And it's kind of like what the Republicans used to do when they were always running against Washington, even when they were Washington.
Exactly.
He's saying, well, this, you know, as if there was a power system, a structure that he wasn't actually a part of. Anyway, Daniel Azar, thank you so much for joining us. But John, we are out of time.
We're out of time. That was Daniel Azar, who joined us from Chicago. He is a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right frontrunner in Brazil's presidential election, was stabbed in the stomach and seriously injured last night during a campaign rally. His assailant was caught. Bolsonaro has courted controversy by equating homosexuality with pedophilia and by saying that a congresswoman with whom he had a conflict was, quote, too ugly to be raped, unquote. We're joined from Bangkok by Pepe Escobar. He's a writer and political analyst. Pepe, welcome back.
Great to be with you guys. Thank you.
It's our pleasure. Hey, can you walk us through some of the rumors that are swirling around this, what appears to be an assassination attempt? We've heard that Bolsonaro was seriously injured and is in intensive care. We've heard that he was wearing a stab vest and the injury was very light. We've heard that the assailant was mentally deranged and this was not a political attack. What's the truth? What can you tell us?
Wow, it's very complicated. It's a mix of a political attack and the fact that the guy confessed yesterday that he was directed by God as well. It's something completely new in the Brazilian landscape, like a religious assassination attempt. This hasn't happened in Brazil. I don't remember anything remotely similar. The guy is not obviously the extreme the centrists and the right and the extreme right were trying to say that he was affiliated with the Workers' Party. This is an absolute lie, in fact. Bolsonaro was transferred today to one of the best hospitals in Latin America, in São Paulo. His condition is stable. I checked this about 10, 15 minutes ago with the sources in São Paulo. But nobody knows if he's going to recover. He has what? He has 4 weeks to recover before the first round. And for the moment, nobody is risking to say anything. So can you imagine if we have Bolsonaro dropping out of the race? The guy who's going to run his place, his second in command, is a fascist general. This is absolutely horrible. And it gets even worse because there was a secret meeting of the top military ranks in Brasilia 2 days ago. I confirmed with some of my friends in São Paulo and in Brasilia. They said that this was a secret meeting and there is a strong possibility, very important, possibility that they even may try attempting to cancel or suspend the elections, which in the current extremely incandescent political situation in Brazil would be, I don't know, people would definitely, obviously there's going to be riots in the streets if that happens.
Pepe Escobar is our guest. We're talking about the stabbing, the assassination attempt of Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate. Let's talk about what's happening on the other side of politics. Lula, the most popular political figure in Brazil, the leader and founder of the Workers' Party, someone who's now incarcerated and jailed on corruption charges, pretty clearly political set of charges because it's designed to prevent him from running, in which case he would have won. He's stepping back now because he's been barred from the election. And Pepe, the Workers' Party vice presidential candidate, Fernando Haddad, who was going to step in and be the substitute candidate for Lula, he's now facing corruption charges all within the last couple of days. Go ahead.
Yes, according to the leadership of the Workers' Party, these charges are completely fabricated. I haven't read them in detail yet, but I trust these sources, in fact. They may be from the Workers' Party. Some of them are from think tanks in São Paulo and in Campinas University in São Paulo as well. And they say that the charges are completely fabricated. And the timing is very suspicious, only 4 weeks before the first round. There are all sorts of scenarios floating around about the famous vote transfer from Lula, which is, his popularity in Brazil when he left government was over 80%. Nowadays is around 69 to 70 something percent, even in jail. If you talk to average Brazilians or in the poorest parts of the country, like in the northeast or parts of the northern region as well, where the Workers' Party is very, very influential. Everybody knows that Lula is being a victim of political persecution. They cannot articulate how exactly and who are the main characters behind the whole drama, which is an extremely complex form of hybrid war. I wrote about this, in fact, when Dilma was impeached in 2016, and every time I'm coming back to the same point. In terms of hybrid war, if we compare this with the color revolutions in Georgia, in Kyrgyzstan, in Ukraine, and then the American coup in Ukraine later on, this is extremely complex, tailored to Brazil, political, congressional, judicial, media coup, in fact. It's a rolling coup, in fact, since 2016 up to 2018, inbuilt in the car wash investigation, which was a one-sided investigation. It was not an investigation to eradicate corruption in the Brazilian political system. It was an investigation to basically isolate and destroy the Workers' Party. There's absolutely no question about that. If you look at all the instances of what happened since 2014, in fact, even before Dilma was reelected in late 2014, the campaign started even before she was reelected. So the first part of the coup was to impeach Dilma. That was accomplished 2 years ago. And the second and most important part of the coup was to throw Lula in jail and prevent him from running, because everybody knew, even 2 years ago, 1 year ago, months ago, that if Lula runs, he wins, hands down. And every poll, even polls that are ideological, let's put it this way, there are lots of polling agencies in Brazil that are heavily ideological. Lula wins in all the polls, all of them. So now that he's prevented from running, and I would say the deadline is going to be, incredibly as it may seem, on 9/11, next Tuesday, in fact. So probably he's going to be barred once again. It's a matter being decided by the Supreme Electoral Tribunal or Commission. And in this case, his votes will have to be transferred to Haddad. Haddad was the former mayor of São Paulo. He's not corrupt at all. Unlike Lula, he's an intellectual. But the problem is he's not known all over Brazil like Lula is. So if Lula goes out, even from prison, saying, this is my guy, the vote transfer, according to many other polls, independent polls now that I'm talking about, they are saying that he can reach, he could soon reach 39% of vote intentions, which means that he's going to be one of the two winners in the first round, and he's going to go to the second round. And the most credible projection until the stabbing, by the way, was that the second round would be between Bolsonaro, and now we don't know what's going to happen to him, and Haddad. So now we have the whole thing. It's it's even crazier than the Mueller investigation in Washington. In fact, nobody knows what's going to happen next. So we could have Haddad on the second round against a fascist general in case Bolsonaro doesn't recover in time. And Bolsonaro himself, you cannot qualify him as extreme right is a subterfuge, I would say. It's an euphemism. He's a fascist.
You have a general who is a fascist and Bolsonaro now stabbed and whose political future is uncertain at the moment, also a fascist. You have Lula and the Workers' Party, the founder of the Workers' Party. The Workers' Party has won every national election four times in a row, including Dilma Rousseff. Dilma Rousseff, who had been a former guerrilla, who had been tortured by the military, who was not a corrupt person, impeached on corruption charges from politicians who, in fact, were the most corrupt people in Brazil. You know, Pepe, we have 2 minutes left. I want to go back to the idea of hybrid war. You mentioned it. You've written about it a lot. Pepe Escobar is an important journalist. He's talking to us from Bangkok, but he's a global journalist. The U.S. Army Chief of Staff defined a hybrid threat in 2008 as an adversary that incorporates diverse and dynamic combinations of conventional, irregular, terrorist, and criminal capabilities. Hybrid war is a real thing. 1 minute left.
Absolutely. Hybrid war is a product of the think tank environment in the U.S. Years later, they were trying to attribute the birth of hybrid war to the Russians. No way. The Russians suffered hybrid war in the Ukraine coup. And they were trying to use some hybrid war techniques in Russia itself, using, among others, Navalny, whose popularity in Russia is less than 1%. But it's crazy. If you read the American press, it's like Navalny is the top opponent to Putin, and he could win any election tomorrow if he was not silenced. This is complete nonsense. But in Brazil, it started way before the rolling coup, as we can say it, that started before Dilma was reelected. It started with the NSA wiretapping everything that was going on in Petrobras and everything that was going on in the Brazilian government, including wiretapping Dilma's own cell phone, in fact. This is public domain. It was revealed by WikiLeaks, among others. And everybody knows that the bulk of what the NSA, the information that the NSA collected on Petrobras, ended up with Judge Moro, who conducted the car wash investigation. Moro, you know, he's a friend of the State Department. It's the same old thing. They pick their, I would say, representatives of comprador elites in different countries. And in Brazil, was very the best thing to do was to pick a judge, because they were trying to replicate something that happened in Italy, the Operazione Manipoliti, the clean hands operation in Italy. The problem is that at the end of the clean hands operation in Italy, we ended up with Berlusconi, which is, by any definition, at least a corrupt oligarch and, worse than all, a sympathizer of a fascism. I'm trying to be polite here.
John, I wish we could keep talking with Pepe Escobar, and hope we can,
unfortunately.
But right now we're out of time.
That was the voice of Pepe Escobar. He joined us from Bangkok. Pepe is a writer and political analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Senator Bernie Sanders announced a new bill yesterday called the Stop Bezos Act, which would require companies to pay for any vital social programs that their employees use because they're paid so little. This is after Amazon became the world's second company to be valued at over $1 trillion this week,
despite paying its workers little and eliminating as many jobs as possible. While Amazon and Jeff Bezos earn more and more, they actually eliminate people's jobs and basic incomes. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Jack, welcome back.
My pleasure to be here.
Jack, in a few hours, you're going to be publishing a piece on your blog that you're entitling Amazon the Job Killer, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Tell us about that.
Well, there's several ways in which Amazon and its business model are going to have a massive impact on job destruction by 2030, based on a recent report by McKinsey Consultants here. Obviously, one way is already happening, and very clearly, Amazon is putting other companies out of business, smaller companies out of business. It started with bookstores and bookstore chains, and then it went to electronic stores and toy stores and mom-and-pop retail. It's beginning to impact big-box retail, Sears, JCPenney, and others, directly putting companies out of business and therefore destroying jobs. And it's also indirectly... We see Walmart and Macy's trying to compete with the same Amazon business model. And as they do more online sales, they close their stores and therefore jobs. Walmart is closing stores, biggest employer in the U.S. Grocery chains now are starting to do the same thing. That's one way jobs are destroyed by Amazon and its business model. Another way is all this hype about Amazon hiring tens of thousands of workers in their warehouses and so forth, while at the same time Amazon is running pilot programs where all those jobs it's creating in its own warehouses are soon going to be replaced by robots and artificial intelligence and so forth. In other words, those people working in the warehouses within 5 to 10 years are going to be gone as well. There's a third way it's a job destroyer, and that is it's moving towards its leading edge with drone deliveries, grocery deliveries, and so forth. There's a million truck drivers in this country, and most of them are local. And what we're going to see is a phenomenon. They're going to be losing a lot of their jobs. FedEx, UPS is going to be moving to drones and also other forms of artificial intelligence. But it's AI, artificial intelligence, that's going to be the big job destroyer. And Alexa, their butler robot, along with Google and Apple having the same thing, are the leading edge of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is going to have a bigger impact on jobs within the next decade even. Then the whole shift to part-time temp work, contingent work, had in the previous two decades in this country. Well, by artificial intelligence, it's going to eliminate ticket sellers, receptionists, movie kiosks, phone sales reps, in-store sales assistants, tellers, all across the board, grocery stores. Already call centers are gone. It's all automated pretty much. And then maintenance. Artificial intelligence means equipment, capital equipment, is going to be able to self-maintain and self-repair. That's going to eliminate millions of types of jobs, food preparation, manufacturing. This McKinsey report indicated that 60% of the occupations by 2030 will be reduced in terms of employment by one-third. Now, if you've got a labor force of 165, 170 million people, you take 60% of them, 60% of that 170 million, and you reduce it by one-third, you're talking about 30 million jobs. 30 million jobs are either going to be eliminated or reduced in terms of hours of work. By 2030.
Jack Rasmus is our guest. Dr. Rasmus is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California. He's the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. And Rasmus is spelled R-A-S-M-U-S, jackrasmus.com. On his blog, you will be able to read within a few hours a new article based on his research, based on the focused on the topic that we're discussing today, how Amazon, now perhaps the biggest corporation in the world, is, unlike the usual narrative about capitalist corporations, not a job creator, but actually a job destroyer. And the article is entitled Job Killer: Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. And Jack Rasmus, let's talk about, you're talking about tomorrow, meaning AI jobs, 30 million jobs lost, perhaps by, I think you said 2030, 60% of the occupations in America reduced in their employment, their job needs by one third, 30 million lost jobs. What happens to people who depend on going to work every day in order to put food on the table and keep a roof over their heads?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, they're not going to have work, or they're going to have even less work than they had. And the next decade is going to have a tremendous negative impact on the society, not on the companies that go in this direction of artificial intelligence that is being driven by Amazon, Google, and Apple in particular. This report shows that it will be a big boon for profits. Profits will, as a result of this big job destruction and eliminating labor costs, will go up by $13 trillion. But wage income will go down by $7 trillion. In other words, you think income inequality is bad now, you wait till 2030. And what are we going to do with all those people without work and without income? That's a big question. You know, some people talk about guaranteed annual income, but Republicans and others say, oh, this is welfare and socialism. Well, what we got is socialism for the rich with this $4 trillion Trump tax cut that's just been passed. They're okay with that kind of socialism, but they're not okay destroying 30 million jobs.
There's a dichotomy here, too, a vicious cycle between workers and investors. Because investors now consider Amazon to be a tech company, not a retail seller of products, but a tech company for exactly the reasons that Jack is delineating here. And that is because they're replacing workers with robots. They're introducing artificial intelligence, and they just aren't going to need as many people in the future as they do now or have in the past. So how do they square, Jack, the notion of the stock price continuing to go up, that revenues continue to go up, people continue to make money while workers are earning less, and then there are fewer of them?
Well, they don't. They're just interested in their capital gains. And of course, now capital gains taxation has been cut in half virtually. Starbucks, just we reported Starbucks before the Trump tax cuts was paying 34%. Now they're paying 17%. The data is just coming out that all kinds of companies, their profits have been increased by 100%, sometimes more, as a result of the subsidization by the U.S. government of corporate America. They're subsidizing them with massive tax cuts, and more tax cuts still coming, being proposed, particularly with capital gains by Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary. And no one's saying anything and doing anything about the declining wages, real wages after inflation. You know, there's a big spin here that wages are rising. Well, I recently wrote on that, too, and showed that, no, real wages are declining by 2%. Here this year. They're not rising. When you look at the 133 million folks who work for a living, wage earners. So, you know, what are we going to do about this? Well, you know, the Republicans aren't going to do anything, and probably the Democrats will do very little. That summarizes the two wings of the corporate party of America, I think. And it's going to be a real crisis here in terms of work and income inequality with this new technology, artificial intelligence technology. But keep in mind, that's not the only way that Amazon is going to be destroying jobs, and it not alone, but the shift towards drones and trucking jobs and automating its own warehouses eliminating the jobs in its own warehouses. It will eliminate the jobs in its warehouses, but all the concessions given by local government, tax cuts and subsidies to Amazon, will not go away. You see, that will remain, but the jobs will be gone.
Jack, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com because he will publish in the next few hours a piece entitled Amazon the Job Killer, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Apple plans to create an online tool for police to formally request data about its users and to assemble a team to train police about what data can and cannot be obtained from the company. We'll look at what this means for privacy. We're joined from Switzerland by Professor Brian Ford. He leads the Decentralized Distributed Systems Lab at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. Welcome back, Professor Ford.
Thank you.
So what exactly does this mean? You know, the police, the federal law enforcement agencies have made a big deal about Apple not cooperating over the last few years. There was, of course, this shooting in San Bernardino, California, where the FBI wanted Apple to crack open the phone so that the FBI could take the data. Apple refused to do that. Are we heading down that road, or is this something different?
A very good question. I feel like this development is fairly unrelated, actually, and it's getting quite a bit of media attention, somewhat undeservedly, because it, of course, involves Apple, which and the whole backdoor issue and you know, encryption of device security, device security encryption issue is very important. This is not a tool that Apple is reportedly developing. In my understanding, is not really directly related to the issue of decryptability of data on devices. It's about the way Apple responds to the types of law enforcement requests for data that Apple already responds to routinely, namely for data that Apple holds, the keys to on its servers, which is separate from the data sitting on devices or end-to-end encrypted.
You know, I was wondering, too, what other companies are planning to do, because it's not just Apple that's been in the news on these privacy issues. It's been Microsoft and Google and Alphabet and all these different tech companies. So are you seeing any trend among tech companies in that they are going to be or already are more willing to work with law enforcement on some of these privacy and encryption issues?
Well, you know, tech companies have to work with law enforcement one way or another. And I think many tech companies would like to make that interaction more systematic and more and be able to enforce clearer processes, for example, to make sure that when a law enforcement request shows up, it really, you know, if it's for data that's supposed to be protected by a warrant, they want to make sure it really does have a judge's approval and has followed the correct law enforcement sign-off processes. And so I think it's from that perspective, from the perspective of just automating and enforcing a law enforcement data request process that they already have to comply with, I think tech companies are naturally going to look for ways to automate that just for their own convenience, to reduce the amount of time their response teams have to spend on these things, especially, you know, invalid or improperly formatted or improperly authorized requests. And so I think that's natural. I think there is some articles have said this is to make things easier for law enforcement. And that might be true. It could also make the process easier for law enforcement too, or more streamlined in some way. And experts are divided on whether that's a good or bad thing. But and there are certainly risks of using automated tools in general. But fundamentally, there's nothing good or bad, I think, about, you know, having a tool, to supervise a process that, you know, the companies have to play with anyway.
We're speaking with Professor Brian Ford. He joins us from Switzerland. He is the leader of the Decentralized Distributed Systems Lab at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne, Switzerland. Brian, there are some very serious privacy concerns here, not just among activists, but this letter that Apple has sent to law enforcement was done really at the request of a Democratic senator, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island.
That's right. So I want to just go over for our audience. I'm going to read a couple sentences from a Reuters article about this. The letter dated September 4th was from Apple General Counsel Kate Adams to U.S. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island. Apple is declining to comment beyond the letter. Apple, and then here's what Reuters says. Apple can and does provide some user data, such as data stored in its iCloud online service to law enforcement officials, if they make a valid legal request. But Apple has sparred with U.S. law enforcement officials because it encrypts its devices in such a way that Apple cannot access the devices if asked to do so. The company said in its letter that it had responded to 14,000 U.S. law enforcement requests last year, including 231 domestic emergency requests that it largely addressed, they say, within 20 minutes of receipt, regardless of the time of day or night. And then here's the final sentence or two. Apple previously handled those requests via email. A company spokesman confirmed by the end of this year, Apple will provide an online tool for law enforcement officials to make and track requests, according to its letter. So it's really just about, according to this, it's not about something new, as Professor Ford is saying. It's really about creating a new tool, a new system, a sort of new template for processing and handling this. But Apple said in its letter that it had trained nearly 1,000 law enforcement officers in how to obtain data from the company. It shows a high degree, Professor Ford, of, as you were suggesting, a real integration between law enforcement and Apple in terms of helping, assisting, facilitating law enforcement access of data kept by Apple, but of Apple customers.
Yeah, the fact that, you know, the numbers that the letter cited, especially the fact that Apple dealt with 14,000 law enforcement requests last year, I think, you know, underline the problem Apple and similar large tech companies are facing in terms of dealing with the magnitude of requests. And, I think that's, the motivation for them to develop tools like this is clear from that. In terms of the training aspect, the mention that Apple is training law enforcement officials to use it. I don't have any specific internal details of how this particular tool works or the specific processes they're training law enforcement to use. But my suspicion is that this is mostly Apple trying to make sure that, in some sense, trying to constrain law enforcement so that they have to deal with less, malformed or ad hoc emails, email requests, just so that they use the tool properly to use the defined process. Now, there definitely are risks, of course, and I alluded to one of the risks of automation, which may well make it easier for law enforcement. And some people believe that for privacy reasons, we shouldn't make anything easier for law enforcement. I personally wouldn't go that far, but I think it is true that to protect privacy, there do need to be substantial barriers to law enforcement, and that's what the classic standard warrant system is designed to provide, where law enforcement has to get a human judge to review the order and sign off on it. And I would hope The process also requires an Apple employee to review, you know, a human employee to review a properly formatted, properly authorized request before it's actually acted upon. Again, I don't have details, but, you know, clearly a tool, you know, automation can help enforce that process and ensure that, you know, Apple doesn't have to deal with more, you know, incorrect uses of the process than it has to. So, you know, that to me, that's just the Occam's razor explanation of what's most likely going on. But, you know, again, I don't have inside information.
Professor Brian Ford is our guest. We're talking to him from Switzerland about Apple's plans to create an online tool for the police to formally request data about its users. 1 minute left. Real quick, Professor Ford, a judge listens to law enforcement's assertions about why a warrant should be issued before someone's property can be searched or seized. Okay, that's a legal process. How is it that Apple has Apple employees who are not officers of the court, but who have some sort of expertise or some sort of credentialing to decide which is valid and which is not valid in terms of law enforcement requests? It seems to be, it gives sort of a level of unfettered discretion, no?
I think that is a concern. I think companies like Apple generally employ paralegals to look at these requests, you know, who have some legal training. And so, you know, there definitely is often some discretion involved, and that can be a problem, but it can also be a benefit because it adds additional resistance to the, you know, an additional check on the law enforcement process to make sure the process is being followed. So, you know, personally, I would rather there be, you know, a human of some kind, you know, in the process, checking those requests in addition to the law enforcement and court side, than, you know, not having a human in the loop at all and having it be a rubber stamp process. But again, it just comes down to what the process is.
That was the voice of Professor Brian Ford. He joined us from Switzerland. He leads the Decentralized Distributed Systems Lab at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, and funniest headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. And Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. Steve, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Steve, we have these three categories: disgusting, misleading, and funniest. And the funny part of this is that I think the really funny headlines that you've selected are actually in the disgusting column. And I want to start with your first one because, yeah, it might be disgusting, but it's, you can't not think this is funny. Go ahead.
There is a lot of overlap between the categories, that's for sure. The first headline is from the New York Times: the U.S. accuses North Korea of plot to hurt economy as spy is charged in Sony hack.
John, here's the New York Times. Don't you feel that the North Koreans are bearing down on us? I mean,
and they're harming our economy. They're harming so much.
They're depriving our people of food and medicine.
Oh, wait a minute. No, that's what we're doing to them.
Oh.
Wait a minute.
Steve, how could the New York Times say that there's a plot by North Korea, a country of 28 million, a country whose military budget is the size of the New York City Police Department, a country that's under the most draconian economic sanctions in the world, can't trade with anybody? How are they? What's the plot to bring down the American economy?
Well, the plot allegedly is that somebody, again, allegedly a North Korean, hacked into Sony 4 years ago in 2014 and caused some, made them reboot their computers. Actually, they had to restore their databases. It was an economic loss to the Sony Corporation, but didn't exactly hit the economy of the United States very hard.
And the other thing about that Sony hack is there's been a lot of speculation that that hack was carried out by aggrieved Sony employees. Again,
you know,
we don't know.
And I spoke with a Sony employee at the time, and the Sony employee said that it was a Sony employee. It was not the North Koreans.
Yeah.
That they had been told to tell people that it was the North Koreans.
You know, I can just imagine the Korean Workers' Party getting together under the leadership of Kim Jong-un about 2014. What can we do to bring down the American economy? What's going to really, really hurt? What's going to cause the economy to scream, in the words of Henry Kissinger, about America's destabilization of economies? They said, let's hack Sony because that'll do it. That'll pretty much do the trick. Steve, let's go on to the next headline. We know that the Russia paranoia and Russia hysteria has reached into all areas of American life. I'm looking at your second headline here.
Yes, even the sports pages, where I saw this headline on Reuters. Nadal, that's Rafael Nadal, survives Russian threat to advance at U.S. Open. Now, maybe I'm paranoid or obsessed with Russiagate or whatever, but when I saw that, my first reaction was literally to think that Nadal had received some death threat from Russia and that he shouldn't play at the U.S. Open. Well, of course, the actual headline is about some Russian guy who beat him, or he didn't beat, but he barely beat this Russian guy to advance. And
everything that's got Russian attached to it is now a threat. And remember, we talked about that article from that sports writer who was referring to Russian female figure skaters. And the headline that we talked about this in another segment, the headline there was "The Russian Bear Baring Its Teeth." Yes, those would be teenage Russian girls in a figure skating contest.
Yeah, it's the Russia threat is everywhere. There's no doubt about it.
And what used to be normal diplomacy now reeks of possible treasonous activity. Let's talk about the next headline.
Next headline from the Washington Post. Ex-advisor to Trump, that's referring to Papadopoulos.
He's being sentenced today.
Ex-advisor to Trump says he told Mueller that candidate liked idea of Putin meeting.
Ooh. Oh, my God. Okay, wait. So, John, now we know what the Mueller probe is all about. George Papadopoulos told Mueller that Trump liked the idea of having a meeting with another head of state, Vladimir Putin.
Is it legal for someone who is running for president to want to meet with foreign leaders?
Yeah. It's the, I think it was the Russian bear baring its teeth again, like those figure skaters.
And Trump was a dupe.
Of course he was. He was a stooge. He wanted to meet with Putin. Again, just for our audience, remember George W. Bush said he looked into Putin's eyes. That was in 2001.
Saw his soul.
He saw his soul. He thought he was a good man. God, can you imagine having somebody say that now? Let's keep going.
Going down the list, we have more news from Russia. This is from the New York Times. The Kremlin wants information. To get it, agents show up with flowers. And this is more shocking news that you know, state forces like the CIA and the FBI actually try to recruit informants. Well, you know, what a shock. Who knew?
Breaking news. The sky is blue. John, you are CIA, former CIA. When you see this headline, the Kremlin wants information to get it, agents show up with flowers.
Right.
I mean, what was your take there?
My take was the economy must be pretty bad because I would show up with, you know, a Rolex.
A Rolex, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Not flowers.
Yeah, because it's about money usually.
It's about money. You know, envelopes stuffed with cash. Remember in The Sopranos, they always had the envelope stuffed with cash and you just tuck it into your jacket pocket. That's what we do too.
Yeah. So flowers, you know, you pick up $10 of flowers from Whole Foods or Safeway.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
It's not working. Okay. Steve, Pat is our guest. We're talking about the most misleading, disgusting, and funny headlines. Steve, those were your disgusting headlines, but they're just funny.
Yeah, they are. It all depends on your point of view.
But here's one that's, it's funny, misleading, disgusting. Is it misleading? This was about Trump and the right to protest.
Yeah, I thought this was misleading. The headline, Washington Post, and it was, of course, widely reported in the same way elsewhere. Trump suggests protesting should be illegal. Well, the funny thing about that headline, or the misleading thing, is that at this hearing for the Supreme Court hearing that this was referring to, 70 people were arrested. So apparently it is illegal. So the fact that the media was all up in arms that Trump was suggesting these protests should be illegal, well, they were illegal, at least according to the rules of the Senate, whatever. And we all know, being protesters, certainly long-time protesters, that the confining of protests and the arresting of protesters has been going on long before Trump.
I hear you, Steve, Pat, but I'm gonna take issue with you on this one. I think Donald Trump really does want to ban protests. I mean, he said during his 2016 campaign, he liked the good old days when people would be taken out on stretchers. And that's then triggered some people in the Trump crowds to actually physically assault people who were peacefully protesting at Trump campaign rallies. And then I think he, you know, under the National Park Service, led by Donald Trump, they're trying to push through new regulations in Washington, D.C., to charge protesters money to file applications for protest permits here in the nation's capital, and also to charge them if Trump decides or the police decide or Secret Service decides to put barricades around people. Trump and Trump's NPS under Zinke, they want to charge the protesters money if they decide to put fences around you. And then he said, well, this is embarrassing. Can't we get rid of protests? It's misleading in the sense that, yes, they were arrested, even though they weren't, should not have been arrested. But I think this is Trump. Trump feels like protests should be banned.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right. Okay. I've won you over.
You did.
I've recruited you. And I just want to tell people the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, which you can go to their website, justiceonline.org. They're getting lots of people, hundreds, maybe thousands of people are signing up in a petition to say, no, people should not be charged a fee just to come and protest in the nation's capital. That would mean free speech isn't free anymore. It takes the free out of free speech. And this is an important initiative on the part of the Trump administration. Anyway, Steve, let's go on. We have 2 minutes left.
Let's talk about Cuba. Our listeners may remember that just after the Trump administration came in, there was this claim, sudden claims that all sorts of people in the Havana embassy, the U.S. embassy in Havana, were getting sick. And the U.S. charged that this was sonic weapons were being beamed at these people. There was no evidence for this whatsoever. And all of this was actually a pretext to help destroy relations between the U.S. and Cuba. And the U.S. withdrew almost all of its diplomats from Cuba, and then expelled most Cuban diplomats from the U.S. So after a year of having this theory be these unproven acoustic or sonic weapons, all of a sudden, a few days ago, the New York Times ran an article claiming that they now know that it's microwaves which were being beamed at these diplomats, which have now, and there's now been a whole spate of articles rebutting this theory. The first one from the Washington Post, and I got a kick out of this headline because we're talking about microwaves now, just like your microwave oven.
Wait, are you explaining the joke? Are you telling us what's funny here before you tell it to us?
No, I just, perhaps a bit. I'm sorry.
Steve, you're supposed to not do that, but go ahead. What's the funny headline here?
Scientists and doctors zap theory that microwave weapon injured Cuba diplomats. That's one headline.
So the funny part was zap, I guess.
Yes. The one I like better was from medium.com, which is actually written by a Cuban. It's the State Department and the flying pig theory, with a subtitle, if you want to explain why pigs fly, first you have to see one flying.
That makes sense. That makes perfect sense. We have time for one more headline, 15 seconds.
Well, let me just finish this. The headline I like best of all was from an article in CNN. It wasn't actually the headline, which was Cuban scientists reject microwaves as source of attacks. But the line in the article, which is going to be the headline of an article I'm writing, is first it was sonic weapons, now microwaves. What's next? Kryptonite?
All right.
Well, we're going to leave it there then. That was the voice of Steve Patt. He joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Is kryptonite real, by the way?
You know, I don't think it is, but there's got to be something out there that is kryptonite-like.
Kryptonite-like.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe uranium.
Yeah.
Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, and he also tweets at Left Eye Blog. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us at Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, at iHeartRadio, and also at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.